My name is Cynthia. It's the 3rd of April, and I'm here with Jonathan at the Arizona Education Offices in Phoenix. Jonathan, could you please state your name and give me formal consent for this oral history to be recorded and used for the Undocumented Voices Project?
My name is Jonathan, and I give consent.
All right. Thank you very much. Welcome, Jonathan. Glad to have you with me. To start off, I would like to ask you a bit more about your personal background. So, for example, where were you born?
So I was born in the U.S. I was born in a small town in Maryland on the border with Virginia, in a really small farming town.
How was your experience growing up there?
It's an interesting place, and it's in the middle of a swamp. It's very segregated. It's half black and half white. It's traditionally plantation country. It's where Harriet Tubman is from, and it's where Frederick Douglass is from. So a lot of the civil rights history of the U.S. happened really close to there, and there's still a lot of racism, and they're still not very used to people who are not either white or black. When I was a kid, people were still called Chinese, usually, if they were anything other than white or black. So,
Could you tell me a bit more about your family?
My family is from different places and mixed. My older brother and sister were born in Mexico City. My mother and their father's different. My mother's side of the family is Italian and Mexican. My dad's side of the family, my father is from Virginia. So he grew up in the segregated South in the U.S. And in Japan, which is an interesting outlier. So my father grew up speaking Japanese and then came back. And then on my mother's side, she moved from Mexico to where I grew up.
Are you yourself undocumented?
I'm not undocumented. I am documented.
All right. So could you tell me a bit more about your experience of being a high school student?
So I went to elementary school and middle school in the U.S., and then when I was a young high schooler, went back to Mexico. As a middle schooler, I got involved in doing some activism that was around queer youth of color in my school, and also realizing a lot of the racial disparity that was happening in my town and trying to figure out what to do about it. But then, by the time I was 14, I spent a little time back in Mexico City, and then at 16 I moved back and finished my education in Mexico City. So I lived in the south of Mexico City and went to a school there.
Right. How was that experience for you?
It was good. It was disconcerting. I had always thought that I had a homeland to go back to, and then I went to Mexico and found that wasn't a homeland either. So it was a disconcerting experience for me as a young person, right? I didn't fit in either place necessarily, and so I had a process of realizing who I was, you know, and how to claim myself. But it was beautiful. I love Mexico City. It was a good place to be. It was good to be back with my family there. It was good. I learned how to be a lot of things that I think that I had really blocked in this country. I think I learned how to express myself in a lot of ways.
Could you elaborate a bit more on that?
One thing is that I realized that I didn't know how to make people laugh until I was living my life in Spanish, and I was all of a sudden able to be funny, and I was able to let myself loose, and I felt easier, which was an interesting thing for me. There was, I think, a lot of childhood in a little town with racial tension, and lots of Baptists can be very confined and uptight. Learning the different ways of navigating communication and talking to people.
Did you pursue higher education?
I started at the the Facultad de Sociología, the sociology faculty in the UNAM, the National Autonomous University of Mexico, and also studying sociology at the ENA, which is the National School of Anthropology and History. And I didn't finish, but I did courses at both of those.
At what point in your life did you become aware of the issues around being undocumented?
It's hard to say the first point. I think the first time I really was clear to me what was happening, I remember when I was probably 13 or 14, standing outside of one of the detention centers where they held people when they picked them up. It was a rural area, so there was lots of migrant farm workers and then construction workers. And at a certain point, we realized that lots of the families in our community were having individuals picked up and deported or detained. And so I guess the first clear memory I have of that is standing outside of a center because we were trying to find one of my friend's fathers. It was a big gray building. It's enormous. It was like a palace, except that it was just all stone, all cinder block, and there was a pipe sticking out of the wall, and it had a flared end, and that was all of the communication. There was no human, like there was no window, there was no nothing. You couldn't go in a door. So I remember speaking into this pipe and then hearing this voice out of it, and just trying to figure out where he was and what was happening to him and how we could get him out. And we didn't know. We didn't have any strategies to do this at that point. We were just figuring it out step by step.
How old were you at that time?
I think I was about 13, 13 or 14. Mm-hmm. I was like an older middle school student or a young high school student.
How did that evolve for you to become an activist? How did you decide that you wanted to support those people?
Mm-hmm. So at that time, that wasn't in my head. I identify activism for me, or like political stuff, was around, mostly around LGBT issues, because I think that's what I was hearing a lot of negativity about. People were very openly homophobic where I grew up, and issues of documentation were the things that we dealt with around the dinner table. They were the things that we stayed up late and friends came over and we figured out how we were going to raise the money to get a bond, who was going to be able to turn it in, who could fill out the papers and show up at the court. So I think, it's like part of my family is what it's, and then my parents come out, though. The history of my folks is I think informs it also. My father was involved in sort of the civil rights movement in Virginia at his time, and my mother comes out of a movement called it was a movement of colonos, a movement of community members outside of Mexico City where people from the countryside and also poor people from the city took over land together and built collective communities. And so both of them came out of really strong backgrounds where they identified economic and racial injustice and what it looked like. And then the way that that we resolved it was that every Sunday in my mother's kitchen is where the ladies from her community came and left the money so that they could buy new land or buy plumbing, for example, for the community kitchen. So solutions were always community. It was always like we come together and we build stuff. We make things so that we can live and we understand that we are an independent people. So it's hard to say exactly like where the click was, but But yeah, I mean, I think that background, that history, the intense racial climate, the fact that my family was immersed in immigrant community and dealing every day with issues of detention and documentation, all of these things, it wasn't a choice. It's just, this is what we do. We build things so that our people can survive.
Definitely. You already touched upon it, that the climate back then was extremely homophobic. So how was that growing up in that time, that place?
Sometimes, yeah, it was interesting. Sometimes I'm 26, and sometimes even with my people who are the same age who have grown up in cities in the U.S. or in Mexico, I feel like I am like a decade older or more because I grew up in a really small town. Like I remember going to school and there would be prayer circles around the flagpole or prayer circles outside of the entrance, and people would throw lots of things in the hallways, and there was lots of like physical attacks, and lots of times that there was only probably less than 10 students in a county school of about 1,500 who are openly identified as gay or lesbian or bisexual at that time. So yeah, there was a lot of internalized hatred, I think, is the longest lasting impact of that. It's taken me a long time to learn how to be, how to love myself and how to be really comfortable with myself and how not to see myself through the eyes of the people that I grew up around.
When was the first time that you actively became an activist or were involved in an organization, and that your identity as LGBT and your experience with undocumented immediately cross or intersect, or did that come later?
It came later. My first... I remember going to meetings of the NAACP, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, from before I could talk. So my parents were engaged in... neither of my parents are black, but there was a strong, powerful structure of black community, and that's where we... Those were my parents' friends, and those were the people. That's how we clicked in, because it didn't. There was nowhere else for us to find a home in the South, and these were people who were community oriented. They understood what colonialism was and racism was, and we could be together and talk together. And so that's the kind of environment that I was raised in. So I was really young. The first time I started one, I was about 12, and we started a. At that time, we called it a Gay Straight Alliance, which now is really, really huge. And at that time, it took us almost a year to start it because the school wouldn't let it, the school banned it. And so we had to appeal and appeal and appeal and appeal. And then eventually we were able to start it. That was the first time I started an organization.
How was that experience like? What did you do?
We gathered a bunch of folks together. We had different kinds of meetings. We had some meetings where we talked about our experiences. We had meetings where we did like kind of healing circles. We had meetings where we talked about politics. There was some other things happening at that time. There was like a couple different wars that the U.S. was engaging in, and there was like racism, really strong racism in our community, and most of us were youth of color or of different backgrounds. And so we also engaged in things like that. Like we did, like we've made like thousands of paper cranes and then filled our school with them, sort of that kind of thing for like art protests. We did... We spent one night painting, like, probably miles of rainbow. They used to sell these big rolls of newsprint, of rainbow newsprint. And then we, like, taped it to all of the walls of the school. for the next day. So a lot of stuff to just be like, at that time, the point was to say we're here, like, because it wasn't, no one had said that before. And so we just did a lot, I think, a lot of that, of saying we're here.
How did you evolve from that point to today, to your activism today?
Mm-hmm.
What happened in that time?
Yeah, so that happened when I was, like, a middle schooler,
right.
And then I was in Mexico City, and that plugged me back into, I think, a lot of my mother's history as working in peasant and working class communities and, like, organizing around economic injustice and, like, just organizing around people's lives. And then when I stopped going to college in Mexico, I came back to the U.S. and lived all over the place. I worked on farms and in forests and in construction. And I worked in California and Texas and Colorado and Alaska and Tennessee and North Carolina and Virginia and Maryland and Arizona and South Dakota. And so I've been, like, all over. And then at some points went back to Mexico. I worked in Guerrero, in southern Guerrero, for a while, and in Mexico City. And so at this time I did manual labor, and then every so often would do short times. Like, I worked as an interpreter at a medical clinic for tomato pickers in a place near where I grew up. I went to Guerrero for a while, and I worked with an organization that does, they work with the national organizations of indigenous peoples in Guerrero. So they do a lot of, like, media outreach or legal representation, and also connecting people with, like, the UN and connecting people with the American Court on Human Rights, the Inter-American Court on Human Rights, the YACR, yeah. So back and forth between being a laborer and a field worker and doing being part of organizations, and feeling alienated in both worlds. I'm from the country, and I love being in the country and in the wilderness or in farm country, but also recognizing that I was in environments where I couldn't be queer, or I couldn't be. Be Mexican, or I couldn't be both of these things, or I could be, but I couldn't talk about them, and really understanding how alienated I was, and that this, in a sense, was like this continuation of when I was a younger child in a really conservative area. It's almost like some part of me was seeking that out and trying to continue to prove myself and be successful in that environment, which I was. I was pretty good in construction. But at some point realized that it didn't matter, like, that was not the point. Being successful in that bad environment was not going to make me a happy person. And then on the other end, being involved in these organizations, which were lots of, like, non-governmental, like NGOs and nonprofits, and feeling in those situations like there was a lot of policy work. There was a lot of reports to members and action alerts and media work and interviews and updates and websites and tweets and feeling like nothing was actually happening, like it was just this buzz of like little electronic signals somewhere between satellites. And so when I moved to Phoenix because I was working in Arizona in the forest in the north, and my sister moved here. And so I moved here with her because it had been a long time. It hadn't been that long, but it had been too long. It had been like a couple years since I'd lived with her for a while. So I came here to be with her and her kids and her husband. Found like community that was working in really concrete ways. And it seemed like a really good place to be, to go to work, to start working on these things in a way that was totally embracing of the community and of the things that I was, and also was doing very solid things, was building stuff.
In which organizations were you involved, or are you still involved?
So my first point was Puente, Human Rights Movement. Back when 1070 was passed, My sister and I came from Virginia because she worked for a union in Virginia, and we came to support the organizing of the mobilization. And so back then, Puente was still part of an organization here called Tona Tierra, which is a little community organization. And so we slept on someone's floor, and we were here for several weeks canvassing, talking to people, knocking on doors, making posters. And then fast forward a couple years, when we came back, we both started going to Puente again. And then through Puente, where I was engaged with them for a while, and then met individuals from QIP, from the Queer Undocumented Immigrant Project, and was invited to be part of that space. And so I went there and really found myself a lot more identified. And also it's a much more community structure. Puente is a large community that's run by staff. And QIP is actually community run. And so there's a big difference in making decisions with everybody, right? And making mistakes and doing things in a not always very smooth way, you know, like learning how media works as you go along. So those are my two points of getting involved. And then I migrated away from Puente for the sake of time and of these other things. We're working really heavily on queer and trans migrant work, and then since migrating away from them, have really seen the full breadth of like what there is out there, from the Center for Neighborhood Leadership to Lucha to really working with ADAC, even PAS, understanding that how big this community is. So
could you elaborate a bit more about what the Puente movement is about?
So Puente movement is born around the protests against 1070, and the commitment of people working in those protests to really build a long-term, durable organization to fight for migrant community. They were initially part of Tona Tierra. They were like maybe a chapter or a sub part of Tona Tierra, and then at some point it made sense for them to be their own. So they sort of packed up and moved out and set up their own. And they do a lot of their work is on a kind of community legal clinic basis. So people come in with different kinds of cases, typically deportation cases, and then they push to get people out of detention, and they do it through a lot of media pressure and a lot of public pressure on ICE, and then political pressure sometimes, but they mostly do media and public. So like the basis of their work are deportation campaigns. It's run by there's a staff of like five people who run different parts of that, and it's also part of some larger national networks like the Endelon, the National Day Labor Organizing Network, and then there's some sort of peripheral projects. They have a garden, they have little things, there's an art project, there's a youth project, but the central piece of this is fighting deportations.
And then the Arizona Queer Undocumented Immigrant Project, what is that about? What are the main goals of that organization?
So it's been dedicated to telling the story of queer and trans migration. So, and in a lot of contexts, what this means is talking in immigrant community, talking about what it is to be queer or trans, and then on the other side, talking in queer and trans community or LGBT community about what it is to be migrant. So a lot of the work has been storytelling. It's been community forums, it's been media, it's been outreach, it's been forums, like informational forums, and they've been working since like 2011, and so they've really laid this groundwork of people understanding that there is a community there, which is important, and that's been a lot of work, I think, that people have done.
Could you give me an example of some of the activities or campaigns?
So last week, yeah, it was last week. There was a double coming out for him in Gilbert Chandler Community College. And a double coming out for him. Essentially, is where members of the group talk and tell their story of double coming out, which is a story of coming out of the closet as LGBT and also coming out of the shadows as undocumented. And in this case, it was to an audience that didn't know much about either. Often it's an audience that's either a migrant audience or it's an LGBT audience. But the double coming out forums are kind of the bread and butter, I guess, of like a lot of Quip's work. Also, organizing events. And two of those I think that are pretty distinctive are one called Somos Familia, We Are Family, and one called Drag for a Dream. They're both fundraising, but they're also both big events where people are brought together in a way that they can talk about or experience this dual identity. So Somos Familia is about sitting families down, sitting migrant families down with LGBTQ community and sharing a dinner and having discussion and finding points in common, whether it's popular music or border politics, whatever that is. And then Drag for a Dream is bringing people together around a show, bringing people together around entertainment, but really talking about what undocumented LGBTQ community looks like and really celebrating the creations and the energy of that community.
How are these events received in the community? Not only in the undocumented LGBT community, mm-hmm. but in the wider community. Do you feel that you are making a difference?
Mm-hmm. So, the work over the last several years has really established that this is a community, that there is a queer and trans undocumented community. And that, in and of itself, people recognizing that that exists is important. Also, Phoenix is the sixth biggest city in the country. And if we go to Mesa, or if we go to any one of the gay bars on the weekend, we're going to find 10 undocumented people or undocumented queer and trans people who have never heard that there is a movement. And so that means that we have a lot more work to do. So the work has been vital. It's been essential. It's been some of the most important work in the country. It's been one of the only chapters of National Quip that's been existing up to this point. But there's a lot more work to do.
How do you see that future evolving?
Well, I think that's why. So Arcoiris is something that started actually kind of between Puente and Quip, with membership from both, like just over a year ago. And kind of what we were looking at was that this amazing storytelling work had happened and was happening, and people understood the community existed, and now our next step was to really start building concrete solutions and responses. What I see is that we don't have as a community lots of volunteer time. We're not able, right, to go spend days volunteering to do this or that. And so we need to have concrete ways to plug into work. And so people, the problems they have in front of them are things like health and housing, deportations, or other interactions with immigration enforcement, jobs. Those are the things that queer and trans community, migrant community are fighting with, right? That's what the fight looks like. That's what injustice is on a daily basis. It's not having these things. And so the way we get people involved is by building those things with community and reaching out to community and engaging, asking, what do you want? You know, do you want to make that happen? And when people say yes, bringing them in and making, you know, building a process that includes everyone who says yes.
So that's how our Arcoiris Liberation Team came into the picture.
Yeah, so it comes from both of these sides, and it comes at an interesting time, which was that 1062 was a law that was proposed that would allow business owners to deny business or services to LGBT community. That was proposed, and it was on the desk of Governor Brewer at the same time that there was a hunger strike going on outside of the ICE ICE headquarters, just a couple blocks away from here at Palm Street and Central. There were about 30 people camped out for 2 weeks on the sidewalk. Around five families who were all they were all in hunger strike. They were all that were not eating for those 2 weeks to demand the freedom of one. A couple of them were children that were in detention. One of them was a husband. So different family members. And so these two things were happening just a few blocks away. There were protests against 1062, and there was this hunger strike. And they were sort of happening in two different worlds. 1062 had the resistance to 1062 had the support of all of the big LGBT organizations in the state. It had national support. There was money behind it. There was media behind it. There was a small business campaign across the city, and they had so much power, business power, and money that they were able to get Jan Brewer to throw it away off her desk. Then a couple blocks away, we have families who haven't seen their children for years, and we're talking about a deportation epidemic that's allowing people to be the victims of crimes in their community because they're not willing or able to communicate with the police, that's stealing brothers and sisters and fathers and children off the streets, and that's touching all of our communities in this really like ravaging way, this really concrete way. You know, it's about losing your family members. It's like a war. You know, it's something that's much more guttural than not being able to buy ice cream, which is terrible, right? We can agree that sort of discrimination is terrible, but weighing these two things together, it's interesting. It was interesting to us, and it was shocking, and it was powerful to see how much support there was for ensuring equal business access to queer and trans community, and how much support there was to versus the very little support that there was for ensuring that our families would stay together and our communities would stay together. And so we were the only people crossing and in present in both of these things. And so essentially Arcuiris started like a week after that. A week after the hunger strike finished, we sat down and we said, we need to find a space between these communities, and we also need to find a way that we can make these deportation campaigns focus on our community. Because all of the organizations have really good intentions and they're not homophobic, but they don't find queer and trans people because they're all waiting for a family member to show up. And as asylum seekers, as people who are often estranged from our family, or in order to live our lives, we have to move out and live separately, no one necessarily reports that we're gone. So recognizing these different things and the need to create a space where we found our people.
So those are the real specific goals of our Arcuiris Liberation Team, so to find concrete solutions.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think are the biggest struggles of that community, of that LGBT undocumented community facing deportation or are being detained?
So we deal with detention, but then also when people get out of detention, what that looks like. And that's something that I remember from Puente, is that detention was the focus of the organization, but the questions at every meeting were, what are we going to do to get job permits? Because now we're all out of detention and we're here in this room and we can't work or keep our children alive. So what does survival look like? And so now essentially we deal with the same thing. We fight detention, but then we also, post-detention, a lot of our membership is coming out of detention, right? So in detention, we're talking about rape and sexual abuse. We're talking about constant verbal and physical abuse from guards and from other people in detention, denial of medication. We've had people die because they've been denied AIDS treatment. People get denied hormone treatment, trans people. And across the board are all put in the wrong gender facilities, despite the fact that there's a law that says that people need to be housed with the gender of their identification. They're not, ever. So this is in detention, not to mention what that looks like if someone actually gets deported to a place that they were fleeing from because of potentially harmful conditions or hazardous conditions. And then post-detention, even somebody with the best asylum case ever, if they are able to put that asylum case in before they get out of detention, they still have 6 months until they're allowed to ask for a work permit, and then another 2 months until it comes through, which is like 9 months, 8 to 9 months. So it's like almost a year before people are legally allowed to work. And then once they are legally allowed to work, then they're going up against trying to get a job as queer and trans people in a state where you're legally allowed to not give people jobs because of their sexual identity or gender identity. So jobs is the biggest thing. We've had people leave the state. And actually, this is one of the biggest reasons that we have to fight these fights, is because otherwise, if we don't fight these fights, then we don't have anyone to fight anything, because everyone has to go to LA or New York where there's more resources and more possibilities. Housing is another huge one. The biggest thing that happens is people come out of detention and they go to back with their families if they have a family, but then their family doesn't allow them or isn't comfortable with them being queer or trans. And so then within a couple weeks, people are terribly depressed. They might be engaging in like different kinds of risky behaviors that people do when they're depressed, like substance abuse or different kinds of self-medication. They can't find jobs, and we're having to work in informal economy. And so even in the best of circumstances, right, that means working without papers or selling cigarettes on the street corner, both of which expose you to ICE and police. The worst of circumstances, we're talking about people having to do, like, going to being trafficked or sex work or different things that are even more risky, which exposes people, again, to more, like, more contact with the police and more contact with immigration. And then health is huge, too. Just getting the resources in a state like Arizona, where it's both a homophobic state and it's also a state where there's a complete ban on undocumented people receiving state-funded resources. So trying to find things out, like, where can somebody who is suicidal go to get a consultation with a psychologist? That kind of stuff is really hard. So I guess that's what, jobs, housing, health, but there's lots of things.
What are the concrete, for example, to first focus on people who are in detention, mm-hmm. what does our Queerest Liberation Team try to do for those people?
Mm-hmm. So we visit once every 2 weeks. We visit folks, and it's often the only visit that people get for over the course of several months. Sometimes it's the first visit they've gotten in a year of being detained. And we write letters, and those are both about moral support. It's about letting people know that they have community, that they're not crazy and they're not alone, and that there is something to fight for, and someone else out there that's looking after them. So moral support is really key. We also, when it seems like a possibility, we work on cases, we make them public, and we'll build campaigns to try to get people out. And so we've had a couple campaigns now for two members to get them out of detention. And those are both successful, and we're in the middle of another campaign right now where basically it's a question of sort of shaming ICE, of making it really clear in public that ICE is doing really terrible things to people, and at a certain point ICE is willing to just let them go so that they don't have to be scrutinized in that way by the public.
Could you give an example of one of those campaigns, what your tactics were, mm-hmm. and what the actual result was, how it was mm-hmm. conceived in the community?
Yeah, so I think the most successful one was Mari Chui, She was a member in detention from starting last spring, so actually about a year ago. And then into the summer, around June, she called us and we learned that she'd suffered a sexual assault, that she was raped by her cellmate. And so we reached out to national partners, to different people who work on either transgender rights or legal representation or migrant community rights and legal representation, and started a media campaign. So we first, well, I should say before the media campaign, there were several weeks of communicating with ICE, of saying, hey, this is going on, what are you doing about it? Getting the response of nothing, everything's okay. And then going up the ladder, communicating with the next person. And so finally when we reached ICE at the national level and got the no from them, we said, okay, well then we're going to, we'll make it public. And so that campaign in particular, we had publicity, like the first public sort of shock went from, it was in The Advocate, was on most of the major news stations like Fox and CNN. It went to both coasts in terms of newspaper coverage. And that was really because of our contacts in other organizations. So that was because of working through this big network of support around the country. And then once that happened, we were able to push an organizational sign-on letter. So we were able to get a letter that was signed on to by like 80 organizations around the country. And part of those organizations were some of the powerful gay rights organizations like Human Rights Campaign and the task force, the Gay and Lesbian Task Force, GLAAD, some organizations that haven't traditionally stood up for trans rights and also haven't traditionally had anything to do with economic or racial justice. We were able to get sign-on to that. So at a certain point, the focus was that, was bringing pressure to bear from all of these powerful organizations. And then from there, we focused on elected officials. Here in Phoenix, we have Kirsten Sinema, who's a member of the LGBT caucus, which is like supposed to represent LGBT rights in the national legislature. So we were really focusing on trying to get her support, and that's kind of where we hit a wall because she refused. And then the caucus said that the most that they were willing to do was just ask how she was doing, but no one was willing to say that she should be out. So when we saw that even our LGBT legislators weren't interested in supporting, we moved back into the media and we kept going at it. And in fall, the pressure lessened on our part. It had been like 4 months of like constant go, 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 go. And we sort of said, we need to reassess. And then it was in December is when we found out that she was going to be out. So essentially it was this year-long process. There was this big push at the beginning, a strong push through the middle, and then essentially we were up against the wall and trying to reach for ideas and more energy. And then after this time, kind of when it quieted down, ICE let her go. And recognized when they let her, when she was released, it was in the decision was they recognized the role of the community, of the LGBT community, in doing that. So that was kind of how that was. It's a really long process. It doesn't happen immediately. But it works.
Did you feel that you created more awareness in the public about the issue?
Yeah. I mean, I think Mighty Chewy's campaign is something that, at least in organizing, at least in migrant movement across the country, everyone knows about it. And in queer and trans community, people who are politically engaged. And it was the first big campaign, right, that was really talking about what it looks like to be trans in detention, in immigration detention. It seems really important.
And then going back to after detention, mm-hmm. So the three biggest problems you've mentioned were work, housing, and health. How do you try to relegate those problems?
Mm-hmm. So we recognize that we're not going to solve them by, like, giving people jobs or giving people beds to sleep in, because there's way more people than we could ever find beds, for example. But what we have to do is create community solutions where people who are experiencing not having a job or not having a place to sleep are able to solve their own problem, or at least work on it, and in doing so are gaining agency and voice. So they're getting their raising their own voice and learning how to tell their own story in a powerful way, and learning how to essentially how to write their own path forward. So really pulling away from some of the charitable models that we've seen, you know, where like people will build a house and then we'll give room to everybody to sleep in, and really focusing, like the Jobs Project, one of the things that we're working on is a micro business. So one of the guys who came out of detention last year is now running a small like pop-up restaurant, and he does the restaurant every month or 2 months, and we invite a bunch of people, he designs a fancy meal, we pre-sell the tickets, and then people come and join us for that evening. And then out of that, we're working on some other ways that people can kind of have a toolkit, so that they can, if they say know how to do nails or know how to do carpentry, they can take some pictures of the work they do, they can put together an ad, we can push it out over social media, and they can, in that way, it's not going to totally solve their need, but it will. Having some money is better than having no money. Health is another one where the way we're going about health is essentially just asking people what the health gaps they experience are, what do they need, what are the challenges that they've dealt with, and based on that, inviting them into the conversation to fix those things. So all of these, we're always using a model where we ask people what's wrong and then invite them to help us fix it. And we understand that not everyone, we're not going to get 100% of people, but if we only get 10% of people, all we have to do is make sure to ask 10 people and we'll get one who wants to commit. So if we ask 100 people, then we'll get a team of 10, and that's really good because we can ask 100 people. So,
you mentioned that there is a large network of these organizations, not only locally, regionally, mm-hmm. and nationally. First of all, how do, for example, Arco-Iris and AZ-Quip work together, and how would you situate these organizations in a larger undocumented youth movement?
Mm-hmm. So Arco-Iris and AZ-Quip work really closely together, to the extent that we don't have an official, like, what do you call it? MOU, Memorandum of Understanding. So it actually sometimes is confusing for membership which one is which and which project is which organization. The definitive difference, right, is, I think, resources, is that they do have their own separate bank accounts. So, like, that is, like, they are clearly separate organizations because we don't get funding from QIP to do the stuff that we do as Arco-Iris and vice versa. And so we're working on that, on figuring that out, how it makes sense to work together in a local way. Nationally, I think it's interesting to see what's happening now in Phoenix and how it's connected to what has happened in other places like California, even like North Carolina, New York, in the way that United We Dream initially was big in these places, and then at a certain point people began looking into more racial and economic justice focused solutions. And in California, for example, they started developing some really, like, fairly radical organizations that really delved into what justice means for our communities. And so then at different points, right, there was UWD, and then there was NIA, the National Immigrant Youth Association, which was like the more radical alternative, and a lot of people joined into that from all over the place. And Arizona has always been part of UWD and part of QIP nationally, even though the QIP here was founded before the national one. So it seemed like an interesting point when the immigrant youth movement here in Arizona is now starting to delve into potentially some more radical politics. In the sense, I use the word radical in the meaning, because radical is about roots. So finding the root of the problem and resolving it. So less policy focused and more roots focused. More focused on, so if the problem is economic injustice, how do we work on changing that? If the problem is colonialism, how do we work on changing that? So I think it's an interesting time. And I think it means that Arizona right now is sort of between a lot of national players who would really like to have a footprint here, or who would like to be, you know, who would like to show that they have a project going on in Arizona, because it's sort of this terrible and exciting place. As far as migrant organizing goes, there's a lot of really harsh realities here. And so to be able to say you do work in Arizona is a big thing. And a lot of national organizations say, we want to do work, we do work there. So it's interesting to find how we are located between all of these. We get a lot of support from organizations like the Transgender Law Center and organizations like the like Endelon, like the National Day Laborers Organizing Network, because they want to support what's happening locally, and they want to support us doing something that makes sense to do here. And we get a lot of support from other local organizations, like in New York, the Queer Detainee Empowerment Project, or in California, from CEJA, from the Californian Immigrant Youth Association Alliance. I don't know what that is. And so there's a lot of these kinds of alliances. And then our relationship with there's like QIP and then Familia are the two big national queer undocumented organizations. And her relationship with them is always good, because they do really great work on a national level, but it's also interesting because they often present that they're doing work here, and yet they're not. So it's an interesting interaction, you know, about are they, just what does that look like, you know, or do we have to be part of them to support each other, or how does that play out?
You see that future evolving, that the smaller local and national organizations will cooperate?
I think we do cooperate, yeah. And so I think the future is that we'll just learn how to do it better.
Yeah.
And I think what Arizona seems to be a little hard-headed, which I think is something that's really good about its organizing. It insists on doing things that are authentic and that make sense for the local climate, which may not be the same things that make sense in New York or Oregon. And so I think the future is that Arizona will continue to decide to do its own thing and do really good local organizing here, and will learn better and better and better how to work with people nationally. That's what I think.
On a personal level, how has becoming, you've already have a long history of being an activist, but mm-hmm. how do you feel that your involvement with, for example, Arizona QIP and our Queerist Liberation Team has influenced you personally?
Mm-hmm. I think that it's I feel more identified with the people that I spend time with than I have ever really before. So I in some ways it feels like I've found a community of people. It won't ever be my community, because I'm not from Arizona. And because my migration history is different, I'm a citizen, but it's a community that I, again, kind of like I said, when I first went back to Mexico, this is like on another level, like I can breathe. I feel easy here and with the people that I'm working with. And it also is, it's a time and a place where we're ready to move, and so ready to do things. And so it seems like I think I spent a lot of my life waiting to move and waiting to be ready to do things. I grew up in, you know, the late 90s was the tech bubble. It was when the U.S. was just blowing up economically, and people were becoming millionaires every day, and the internet was going full throttle, and it was supposed to be like the most abundant, wealthy country in the world. And I lived in a place where people lived in half torn apart trailers with, you know, with a tent next door, and couldn't feed their kids. And so I've always had this feeling of like, there's all these terrible things happening. We need to change things, and yet there's this just heavy pressure of saying everything's okay. There's nothing to change. Don't worry about it. This is all. We are at the end of history. We've already done it all. We have justice. So there's a lot of relief being in a community of people where we're all on the same page of understanding that there's a lot of ways to go. There's a lot of path ahead of us, and that we really need to work on it. So in that sense, it's like really fulfilling to be part of this and to be here.
A little bit more about the identity. So how do you see the undocumented identity intersect with the LGBT identity?
Mm-hmm. I think there's some interesting things on both sides. Through most of history, queer and trans people, especially in this continent, we've had very much accepted roles in our societies, and often we've been identified as having special roles. So we've been caretakers, sometimes we've been warriors, sometimes we've been visionaries, sometimes, there was like one, at least that I'm thinking of, one group of people who considered queer and trans people to be like the gatekeepers to the underworld, you know, all sorts of things. But there's always been, in the traditional cultures of this continent, at least the ones that I have learned about, there's been this a recognition that we have a unique viewpoint, and that because we're slightly outside of the circle of nuclear families or of heteronormative culture, we have a slightly wider view. Or maybe it's a slightly narrow view, but we can see things that other people can't see. And so I think that queer and trans people always bring incisive vision and creative vision to the work that we do. And this is why any of the movements that have happened in this country for racial and economic justice, even if the top leaders are not, if you go just below the surface, the people who wrote the books and wrote the plans and designed the marches were queer and trans people. So I think that's important to understand that there's an because we have been outside, we have had to become visionary. We have to make new stuff, you know, in a very simple way. When people are resourceful, any person, if you put them outside a box or outside of a house, they'll figure out how to live outside of it. So we've been put outside of the box. And we have to figure that out. So it means that we can create new solutions, and that makes us able to create new solutions and be visionary. I think my experience, and this is, I can't speak as an undocumented person, but I can speak as a person who, I didn't grow up with an American dream. I grew up with, I always think of it as the dream of Guayamilpas. And Guayamilpas is the community that my mother built in the Pedregales in the south of Mexico City, in the volcanic rock fields. And the old ladies there say that there were still snakes crawling out of the caves, and there was still water in the low parts. And today, that's a community that, while many other communities founded at the same time, who never organized, still don't have running water or paved streets or plumbing or trash collection. It's a community where everyone owns their own home. The streets are paved. Everything is plumbed. People are very poor, but they have their stuff, and things work. And so what I remember, the central image, the like the logo or the emblem, I guess, of the community, well, we had a poster on our wall. It was a circle, and it was a mound of dirt, and with a shovel sticking out of one side and a pitchfork in the other. And then all of these pictures around the edge and like that old sepia-toned photograph of people building stuff together. And so that's the vision that I grew up with. It's not a vision of manifest destiny and westward expansion and cities on hills and shining lights of knowledge. It's a vision of people standing together and working together and understanding that we're on a continent that we've been on for thousands of years and that none of this is new, but there are lots of new problems and that we really have to be recovering from what colonialism has brought to us, and we have to be building solutions every day. And so I think there's something essential about having roots outside of this country that allow you to see through its story and see through its mythology. And then I think the question of being undocumented, I can just say in my personal experience, having undocumented family and having undocumented community is an even more acute experience, an even more pointed experience of essentially just not having any reason to have faith in an American system, because you can't call the police and you are afraid to go to the post office. So there's just an essential, it's not a mistrust, because that sounds like a bias. It's not a bias, it's just that there are no assumptions. We don't assume that things are okay. We investigate.
How do you feel about the tactic of the undocumented youth movement of coming out undocumented and unafraid? Here we go.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the continued recording with Jonathan. So I was just asking you about the tactic of coming out as undocumented and unafraid. So how you feel about that?
Mm-hmm. I think one of the most important things we can do is openly recognize the things that people will use to undermine us, and openly recognize the ways that people say that we are, that people say that we are less worthy, or say that we are not not as much. I think if we claim these things publicly and proudly, then we turn them from what people call weaknesses into tools, and into defenses, and into points of strength. I mean, yeah. So I think it's a powerful.
So you already mentioned some of the policies. So for example, on a state level, restrictive policies like SB 1017 and Proposition 300 have implemented. How do you feel about SB 1070? And of course, yeah, this policy has personally affected you in that it became a motivator for your activism.
Mm-hmm. Well, so my family here in Arizona, we're as of very recently now, we're all documented. But up until very recently, the reality of not calling police for anything, the reality of risking family separation for like fairly small things is huge. And I think that its psychological impact is huge in terms of people being able and willing to step out and really use their voice in society.
Mm-hmm. And then Proposition 300, in turn, provides that university students who are not U.S. citizens or permanent residents or do not have lawful immigration status are not eligible for in-state tuition rates or any financial aid that is funded by the state. And also, on a federal level, a comprehensive DREAM Act has not yet been able to pass. In 2012, President Barack Obama passed the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals,
mm-hmm.
Complemented that with the Deferred Action for Parental Accountability. What do you think about that policy. Do you feel that immigration reform should be focused at the local, the state, or the federal level?
I think that we have to take success where we can get it. I said that wrong. We have to demand success where we can get it and not accept anything as a win. We have to, everything is a step toward, but it's going to be a long time before we see something that actually does what we need it to do. Federal level immigration reform is terrifying in the way that it promises long-term criminalization for the community that continues to cross the border, and for the way that it militarizes the border, and for the way that it promises persecution for people already in this country without documents and with criminal backgrounds. Those things, and the fact that those would now be those categories, those things would be written into federal law is, like, very worrying. So in that sense, a national package that we know that they're going to put all of these terrible things into, it's hard to know what the balance is. What are those things really worth? DACA also is clearly huge and important and has changed the life of my community has changed lives, like, really significantly. It's also reversible. It's incomplete. It doesn't give a pathway to the basic rights that any person already has, so it doesn't recognize our human rights. So it's very much not enough, not the whole thing. The way that this country has traditionally worked is that instead of solving problems, it just gives a little bit of a palliative. It gives something to make you feel a little bit better. So I wonder, you know, what we saw in the immigrant youth movement was that after DACA was passed, a lot of people said, oh, it's over. Where it's okay. And they pulled out of the movement, and the movement lost a lot of momentum. And then also, what does it look like now that people have DACA and can get different kinds of jobs? They can't dedicate time to the movement. So it's really changed the nature of the youth movement in the way that people engage and in the amount that they're able to engage. So I don't know. What I know, I guess, is that in my personal focus is that national policy always feels like it makes me give away too much to get whatever they're promising. And I know that at a local level, we can't do it completely at a local level, but I do know that we can push for policy that will be good. And we can know what that balance is a little better. So I feel more comfortable in my work pushing for local policy, like the One ID for Phoenix, the municipal identification for Phoenix City, and that kind of thing, that I'm more comfortable with that than national. But I recognize the importance of both.
Mm-hmm. How do you see it evolving towards the future? Like you said, a lot of people pulled out after DACA. How do you see that evolving?
It's hard to know.
Mm-hmm.
On a policy side, just based on results up to now, it seems like no one is proposing even the minimum things that are necessary for this to be a country that respects human rights, and for this to be a country that respects working rights. So it's hard to know, because there's no, and this is where I think this, we can't look at immigration by itself. Because we live in a country where Black people have been citizens now for a very long time. So have Native people. So have lots of Mexicans and Hispanic people. And poor white people. And none of their human rights are recognized. And we're still a country that pursues genocidal policies, both within and outside of our national borders. So it's like, how do we solve it for justice? I don't know. It seems like the end result is going to be some kind of Machiavellian negotiation and compromise. that puts a lot of really terrible things into law and leaves a lot of work to do.
Mm-hmm. And have you been, like you said, you've seen the consequences in your community. Have you been involved with people who have been personally affected by these policies?
The good ones, like DACA?
The good ones?
Yeah, I mean, one of my best friends, DACA, is just coming through now because he had some complications and it took him this many years to get it since it was passed originally. And that changes everything. In terms of the ability to get work, that's paid what he deserves, his mobility, his ability to be here instead of having to follow the work around, on a lot of levels. Even some of Obama's administrative changes before DACA in terms of being able to request your permit on family basis or on extreme hardship basis before you had to leave the country, instead of leaving the country, requesting the permit, and then waiting 10 years. That change. My family has been able to, that's why we are documented as a family now, is because my family members were able to, on the basis of extreme hardship for their citizen family, ask for a permit, get it approved, and then go back and have their final interview instead of going back and waiting years and years and years before they saw their kids again. So those things are real, and that's why we can't deny them, is because it changes, you know, I mean, it changes things. Mm-hmm. They really do. So, yeah.
So you see it as possibly positively evolving, and then, in your opinion, keep pushing locally.
Yeah, well, again, I think that whatever happens on a national level, there's going to be these things that are concessions that are going to make life easier for some chunks of people, and it's going to be important to recognize how life has changed for those people, but they're going to, at the same time, implement big areas of law that are still continuing to do really bad things. Like right now, with the DACA that was implemented, we see that the new enforcement priorities, the new PEP that Obama put into place that supposedly refocuses deportation and detention on people who are like high criminal priorities. This does things like giving ICE a reason to keep Nicole Hernandez Polanco in detention. They say that under the new policy, because she was deported once as a minor who is seeking political asylum, is now a priority for detention despite having no criminal record. So, it is good because my friends and family have documentation now and are able to work. It is bad because there was no intent to solve anything. It was just an intent to give something so that people would stop complaining. It was an intention to give a little bit, give a concession so that people would not push so hard. So we have to accept the victories that we get and we have to keep pushing.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for this interview, Jonathan. Mm-hmm. Thank you for answering my questions.
Totally.